This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann, and I am joined today by Tim Lynch. The fabulous Tim Lynch, the incredibly awesome Tim Lynch, is that enough?
That'll do. They're good though, Sam. I like these intros, they're getting better and better. I'm telling you, they are going to be my alarm clock to wake up soon.
So Tim, you are doing your doctorate.
I am.
You talked to a lot of people about anger.
I did.
You talked to some angry people.
I talked to some and I am still talking to some angry people, yep.
And you've been talking with some hopeful people.
I have been talking to some very hopeful people. One of those hopeful people I got to speak to was Dr. Ahurangi Heke, who I spoke to this week. Now, this is a man of quite remarkable caliber. Left school when he was 15, went on to now have 6 degrees, including being a doctor. He's got consulting roles, including work with Google, Case Western Reserve, University of Cleveland in Ohio, done work with the Center of American Indian Rural Health Inquiry. He's also worked on sustainability training, and he holds a position of honorary research professor at the University of Otago. On top of that, he's also collaborated with Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Worked on the Global Obesity Prevention Centre, and he's in the top 100 Māori leaders in New Zealand at the moment. And this is on top of having his own practice. So he's a busy man, and I was incredibly fortunate and incredibly lucky to be able to sit down and have a bit of a chat with him about things, which was right before I was about to head off to where he was brought up, which is in the middle of the South Island around the Alps. I was about to head off to Uhau and spend some time in the backcountry there.
We're going to run this as 2 weeks.
Let's go for 2 weeks.
Because we tried chopping it up, and there's too much good stuff.
I couldn't do it. And I'll tell you what, when I did my master's degree, I sat in my first lecture on sustainability, and I was saying to my supervisor afterwards, Nick, I said, man, that was a lot of stuff to think about. And Nick said, Tim, you're going to be thinking about this stuff for the rest of your life. This was the same conversation. I'm still thinking about the stuff that he was telling me.
So what are we looking out for in terms of thinking about?
Well, a lot of it had an indigenous bent to it, obviously. And the thing that the stuff that's really fascinating about this is if we think of climate change in a whole other way of viewing it as not being a human experience, I'll leave it at that.
Kone taku mihi karanga kia hoi. E mara, ko tēnei... E ki ake nei ko Ihirangi Heke tēnei, no te iwi o waka tō tainui, nei rea te mihi karanga kia koe mo te manaakitanga o tēnei o tātou kauhau hui. My name is Ihirangi Heke, I'm from waka tō tainui, and looking forward to having a chat. I spent more time in the South Island than I did in the North. I left there when I was 9 years old and didn't come back for 25 years, almost 30 years. I had 13 years of study at Otago University. We owned a house in Dunedin. So the South Island looked after me particularly well. I lived in Lake Tekapo for a year. I went to Fairlie High School. And as you suggested, I did some work in Milford Sound, Redburn Greenstone area. doing some guiding on the tracks in there. Yeah, although because I'm from Waikato, initially I've come out of a river, and that never really goes away. That's part of your genetic makeup that's permanent. But I grew up in mountains around fast-flowing, medium-sized rivers, whereas Waikato was a large, slow-moving river. It was a change in the layout of the land, which inevitably affected me physiologically and intellectually.
You know, at the age of 15, you left school. And I wonder if, because, you know, like myself, I didn't do well at school. You know, you went on to do a PhD and you become world-renowned in several things. You're now a doctor. You know, how did that pathway influence the way you think about knowledge and what knowledge is and how knowledge is transferred, contained, owned, transferred?
When I was 15, it wasn't like I wanted to leave. The principal I had said I just wasn't really cut out for anything academic. And my brother and father worked on the roads for Ministry of Works, which I think is Works Infrastructure now. And he said, you're probably better off with your brother and father doing some labour, you know, manual labour. And so I left at 15, and my father said to me, if you're not working, then you're out. So I was out of the house the same day, and that was a pretty quick surprise at 15. Didn't know any differently, though, and wasn't that unusual amongst a lot of my peers, especially those that were Māori. Not as common in the South Island, but in the North, 6 out of 10 of my mates were in the same situation. So that changed things, and there were three pivotal moments, really. One was I left there and I started working out in the environment, working in the bush, Milford. I was working with outdoor ed programs from a really young age, guiding people, mountain bikes, guiding them with skiing, doing a whole range of different topics that were all outdoor related. I did several years of working with rock walls, building stone walls in the central Otago area that were dry stone walls. So it was a different approach again. So that was the first stage. It was that I was outside all day, every day, and really closely connected to environment. The consequence of that was I learned a lot of things about how environment acts without knowing that I was learning it. Following on from that, I did that for 10 years. I didn't go to university until I was 25 because I couldn't go with having no high school education. I failed school cert, all of the things that you needed to go to university I didn't have. So I went at 25, and then I failed every paper in the university as well in the first year because I had no skills about how to do anything. So that shouldn't have been surprising to me, but it kind of was. So I went back to building walls and working out in the bush and working up in the mountains for another couple of years. Bumped into a lecturer who was Māori and from in Dunedin. He said, I got a C minus. He said he'd consider taking me on to see if I was capable of anything else. And that was a turning point. So I moved from being practically based into learning an academic pathway. And that took a number of years. I've got 6 degrees now. And after completing those, I left for the Middle East, worked there for a short while, came back for a visit. And then I ended up working for a Māori health authority up the east coast of the North Island near Tolaga Bay. And that was the third component. So I went through practical environmentally centred concepts, then through an academic pathway that ended in a PhD, or didn't actually, there was more after that. And then was community-based with groups that were cynical of academia and expected a high level of exchange for their input and return of effort. So that was 2007, and one of the chaps that marked my PhD was Mason Jury. Professor Mason Jury wrote the Whare Tapu Whā model. And he was the one that pushed me and said, you need to do something else. So I wrote the Atua Matua framework, and that's pretty much where I've been working out of since. Well, I think it was the perfect storm in a lot of ways, and it was just coincidental. None of it was planned, and that I got the practical experience first. And I knew things about how environments behave without knowing I even knew it. And I could tell people when the weather was going to change and that we needed to get moving or we'd get caught out. And the southerly in the bottom of the South Island is not to be messed with, whereas in the far north it doesn't matter that so much. Yeah. So I learned that practical stuff. Then I got the academic run behind it. And then I got the consensus of Māori communities, which is grassroots level testing of just what you're up to. So the combination of those three turned out to be useful for a number of our people right at the right time. Just coincidence.
Like one of the things you talk about in is you talk about this idea of land as whakapapa, like a living ancestor rather than a resource. How does that worldview differ from how the environment is sort of viewed in a Western framework?
Well, there's quite a few answers to that one, and some of them are contentious, but one of them is, I think, one of the sixth, not necessarily, maybe a commandment, I can't remember what the term is, in Christianity, that and so you shall have domain over all the animals, the plants, and the environment. That one had quite a big impact on a number of people that arrived here to colonise the country, that they believed it was their God-given right to exploit what we didn't exploit in the same manner. And as Indigenous globally and as Māori, when we stand up to introduce ourselves, we'll tell you what river and mountain caused us. And so from there, it's a relationship. It's not one that's extractive as much as these are the things you can take and use because you're the superior being as a human. So it meant that that anthropocentric arrogance was something unknown to us, and that occasionally it would turn up, but what I was trying to help our people with is that I worked in population health mostly. I did 10 years too, incidentally, with the New Zealand Academy of Sports South as a sports psychologist. That was post PhD, which was an interesting path in its own right of going down high performance sport, but it wasn't satisfying. When I turned and went down the epidemiological and population health space and biostatistics, I worked as a research fellow for Auckland University in that space. And in there, I started to realise that our health was continuing to deteriorate as Native people globally, and that the idea of being human-centred was inconsistent with Indigenous thought. And that wherever environment was used as something that could be exploited, while that may have suited neoliberal capitalist ideals, it didn't suit us at all. So at that point, when I wrote Atua Matua, the Māori Health Framework, it was to flip that on its head and say that health had nothing to do with people. It had everything to do with the environment that caused it, which ironically meant that systems dynamics practitioners all of a sudden got interested, because now I was talking about a macro level understanding of the impact of water, land, and stars. And so they started to ask questions. I wrote a couple of papers. One of them was with funding from Johns Hopkins Medical out of Baltimore. And that was quite an unusual funding line, because they didn't usually fund people outside of the States. And they wanted to know more about an Indigenous view on systems. And I said to them, well, we've practiced this for over 3,000 years in the form of whakapapa. And whakapapa is something that's a dynamic tool for being able to practice some of the aspects that we talked about in terms of if you are from a mountain or you are from an ocean, how do you reflect that in the way you act? And so that's not just physically, but it's intellectually and spiritually. How do you subconsciously project the things from the environment that cause you to be the way you are? So there were two majors that I wrote into this framework that caused a lot of, I wouldn't say concerns, but mainstream and Māori were like, where's this come from? We don't know anything about it. And I said, well, firstly, you used to practice this way as Māori. Secondly, it's far more productive for us as Māori to be environmentally centred because it removes blame and guilt of not being able to produce the health outcomes that we used to get. So that idea of not being human-centred was, and continues to be, quite a big intellectual leap for academics and Indigenous alike. And secondly, the idea that whakapapa is systems has taken a while for people to get their head around, but I've had to point out that systems dynamics in its contemporary form started in the 70s, and we've been at it for 3,500 years. So we're okay at it, but nobody ever asked, and nor do we care whether they want to ask, but since they did, that's what we're doing.
Can I ask you this, like, because you made a throwaway comment there, like, whakapapa are systems, and that's a big statement. Could you just sort of elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, of course. At the moment, if you were to ask Māori, what is whakapapa, when in New Zealand, they'll tell you, oh, it's a list of names, you know, it tells you about your family tree and your connection between you and your grandparents, great-grandparents, and so on. That's been a misappropriation of the terminology by Christianity to a certain degree, of wanting it to be a relationship between people, whereas for Māori, it's between people and environment. And whakapapa has never been a noun for Māori, but we started to align to non-Indigenous thinking that whakapapa meant to just list something, when in fact it's something you do, and you do it each day. And when you mentioned earlier, you were looking at takapō and thinking, man, I'd really like to ride my motorbike through here. This would be quite cool. That's an act of whakapapa because it stretches you physically, psychologically, and intellectually or spiritually because of the direct feedback you get from the wind hitting your face and getting under your helmet and so on that gives you a real visceral experience of the environment. And that's whakapapa in action. So it's always been something you do, not something you talk about. And we've had to decolonize the thinking of Māori about what the real intent of whakapapa is, which is to strengthen the likelihood of genetic material being in a better state than we left it. So it's taken some work, and I'm surprised you picked up on it, but pleased. And you certainly seem to... A lot of the statements I've already given you, people can't get their heads around. It's completely beyond them. They just nod their head and go, okay, that's nice, and move on. But I get the feeling I can't slip this shit past you. You know what's going on here.
Well, it's interesting what you say, that whakapapa as being like a thing of action. And like for myself, I live at Harwood down the end of the peninsula. And I can explain the historical roots of that, but that's all well and good. But the thing that sticks with me is the active intent and energy that is required to ride into that southerly or northerly wind to get home or to get to work engages me within that environment. Is that what you speak to as part of the whakapapa?
Yeah, totally. Like, I don't think that for a moment your experience of wind is different from my experience of wind. I have a way of verbalising it, potentially, which is that they come under an Atua name of Tāwhiri Mātia, is continuing his role to attack humans because we agreed to the separation of the earth and the sky. And so that's a role that continues on. But our role as humans is to fight back against that and say, well, actually, whether you're a storm or not, we're still going. And from that, we get growth in terms of it provides us with resilience. It provides us with an opportunity to be tested. And it's no coincidence, and this one always surprised me with New Zealanders in general. If they ever listen to someone Māori stand up and speak, they'll introduce themselves as a river and a mountain, never who they are. And so you shouldn't be surprised that, therefore, health is based around our ability to enact whakapapa by doing things that stretch and pull it, such as riding to work when it's a blowing, howling southerly. I lived in McKendree Bay. We only house there, so I'm not going to...
Time for some music, Tim.
Alrighty. Hey, at the time this goes to air, the Dunedin Film Festival will be on, and there's a couple of really good music documentaries on there. The first one being Life in One Chord, about Dunedin's own Shane Carter. So I thought it was appropriate that we play some Straitjacket Fitz. Now, the thing about Straitjacket Fitz was it was an interplay between Andrew Ruff and his delicate musical sensibilities and the kind of more jagged, abrasive stuff that came from Shane Carter. When Andrew Ruff left and Shane was left to do his own thing, you got this incredible period of music coming out of Straitjacket Fitz where you couldn't tell, I couldn't tell if it was Straitjacket Fitz were borrowing from the 3Ds, another amazing Dunedin band, or the 3Ds were borrowing from Shane Carter, the Straitjacket Fitz. But either way, I think this song kind of encapsulates that cross-pollinization. So this is a song called Done by the Straitjacket Fitz.
Conversation with Ihirangi Heki.
And it's that engagement with the environment.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And that's, I think, in a lot of ways, it's like, you know, for someone who's spent a lot of time living in, you know, Europe, United Kingdom, that ability to engage with the environment, it's almost like a distinctly New Zealand thing.
Mm. Although, in the last year or two, I've been getting requests from Europeans to discuss how it is we're doing what we're doing and why we would be doing these things. And the irony is not lost on me that, you know, someone, I've been doing some lecturing for the School of Tropical Disease and Hygiene in London. So they just invited me to be there in person. And I've said, maybe. And I've done a couple of years for them. And the King's Foundation made contact as well about just what is it we're doing and how are we achieving these concepts. And so there's a burgeoning interest in Indigenous ways of knowing. And this is an extension to understanding that in this current environment, and I mean as contemporary as you can get your head around, Indigenous thought is a form of universal knowledge that could underpin the ability for AI to learn in another way that isn't human-centered and therefore doesn't enrich more trillionaires, but uses its strength and ability to learn in a different way that could contribute to all of humanity, let alone to environment.
But like, so you wouldn't see like that as being like another form of colonization?
Google?
Well, the AI embracing the notion of like Indigenous like principles and stuff.
It could be, but one of the things that's occurring is, firstly, we need to be in the room. Otherwise, things will get done to us and not by us, which means that we needed to initiate a rationale that was agreeable to get access. And part of the ongoing issue around this is, which you probably know, AI is chewing through power. If you ask AI to generate a photograph for you, it's the equivalent of charging your phone from dead 52 times. For one photograph. So chewing through it. And we're currently asking it to come up with solutions for its own power use, but it requires more power to get more compute to answer the issue. And so it's a place that's fraught with a real issue for Indigenous because we could get more sidelined and more deficit outcomes if we don't engage, if we're not present. And that doesn't necessarily mean providing content, but it could mean providing processing power for information or data specifically from the Pacific that could contribute to climate change, that could contribute to more visibility of alternative ways of knowing. But because the dominant group is American, Russian, and Chinese, their interests aren't in that space. But it means that the dominant models are learning from neoliberal ideals, and so it has the tendency, the threat, to enhance those kinds of thinking. So part of it is to address what AI is currently doing, and that it learns like a baby, so what you surround it with is what it will become. And so we need to give it an alternative view, an alternative voice, and we're attempting to do that. Is it colonization again? Well, part of thinking about whether it's China, Russia, America, another consideration is that there's every likelihood that parochialism that exists from countries wanting to lead in a space like AI might become a moot point, and that it may be a Google that runs it, and that it won't be a country. It'll be a tech company that take over the running of the world because they've got the facilities and the money and the investment regimes to influence where AI could go. So that means that now it's not a discussion about which country is going to get there first. It might be a discussion about which tech company is going to get there first. And if we're having that discussion with Google now, we're in the room, which means that we could never compete as a country with China, America, or Russia as a country in terms of being New Zealanders. But we can compete in other ways through being associated with channels that allow us to talk to people who are also questioning the process. And I mean this in terms of current data center builds. The companies that are involved in that are starting to question themselves about is it ethical what they're doing because they're handing more power into the hyperscalers, which are, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, Netflix, Google, And so they're looking for alternative models, and we're it. I know it's a long-winded answer, but it's not an edgy question.
It was a good one, though. It was a good answer.
Tim, time to sneak in another music break.
Well, the second documentary that's on at the film festival, which I thought was really interesting, is on Don McGlashan, another incredibly famous New Zealand musician. So I thought it was appropriate to have something from him. So this is a classic song that doesn't need an intro, really. This is Anchor Me.
Anchor me, anchor me, anchor me. double sprite of the wild coasts, secluded inlets, and forest and beaches of Otago Peninsula, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi aroha nui kia koutou, ko tā hoho. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars, in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day. Who you are, a triumph of nature's art. Perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. I talk to you all, of course, on my birthday morning, so it's very exciting to get to talk to you all on my birthday morning. Thank you. And thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me. It's been a great pleasure and privilege to be part of this show for the last several years. And of course, all the stories, all the sharing, all the dreams, all the revelations, all the beautiful, beautiful ways in which we are human beings are celebrated in this show. And to be part of it is just a dream come true. So thank you all. And not only do I speak to you from my birthday morning here in glorious Portobello with all the beautiful native manu singing around me and the beautiful introduced birds singing around me, but I also speak to you from quite a different life situation from when I last spoke to you. So I had a dream more than a year ago now about standing on a headland out on the peninsula talking to a Swiss scientist lady about the hoi haws, the yellow penguin's gut microbiome. And in this dream, I was standing on this headland and I was looking at the pyramids, which are these beautiful volcanic rock formations, but from the other side. And I'd never been to this headland. And I thought, right, this is a tohu. It's time for me to be called in a new direction. So I have left my beautiful heart's home, Orokonui Eco Sanctuary, after 16 years, and I have returned to my childhood home of the Otago Peninsula, where I had my first job at the aquarium, and I have started at the Otago Peninsula Ecological Restoration Alliance, or the OPRA, to help the hoi haw, to help the yellow-eyed penguin. And I'm learning more and more about the microbiome and the role of the microbiome, and I found my dream headland. After about 2 weeks of working at the OPRA, I learned to drive the Polaris's, the wee ATVs, and I drove up right to the edge of our southern boundary, and here was my dream headland. So I'm standing there, and I'm looking back at Orkia, I'm looking back at the pyramids from the other side. And I've been working with lots of scientists to understand how we can best analyse the microbiomes of the northern population, southern population, understand how we can best hopefully do microbiome transplants. But of course, all of this is in the very early stages. And I'm really hoping that in this way, I can help the hoi haw. We're at a stage where there are around, well, less than 200 left with us on the mainland here. So important to do what we can to help them, especially as we now know they're genetically distinct from the southern populations. So with this mainland population, less than 200 left, it's really time for helping them. So I'm very grateful. And of course, this affirms to me the importance of connecting with our dreams, connecting with those calls to action that we are receiving when we sleep. And I hope for you in your life, you're having opportunities to be guided by your connection to the living world. And I know for all of us that we have these beautiful gifts within us that we bring out into the world and share and help the world in this way. So I really hope for you that these moments of illumination are allowing you to share even more in the best way for you. I hope you all have a wonderful day today. It's lovely to get to speak to you again, and I look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I've got 10 minutes with me. He's brought his conversation with Dr. Iharangi Hake.
My question for you there is, as a Māori man from New Zealand, like with full tamaoko, how is it? How do you navigate the sort of institutional, i.e. Google, etc., and the indigenous? How do you navigate those worlds? How do you get between them?
Well, I was a slippery bastard. I got an unprecedented contract with Google that they can't own anything I say. It took 8 lawyers and a lot of back and forth, and to and fro, and no one else has that contract. But I would say it's worthless, in that if they decide they want it, they're going to take it. But at the moment, what I'm trying to convince our people is we need to be present. We need to know what some of these discussions are. We need to be educated and aware. And I am, because I'm surrounded by the best AI engineers that Google have. 3 weeks ago, I met with the AI lead for all of Google in Vancouver. She came to me. So those are fairly strong indicators of what their intent is, to try and understand alternative models that may not lead to the destruction of the world through AI deciding that humans are a pain, a problem.
If we move past that and we start thinking about like this idea of systems and conflict and conversation and stuff, like if we think of like ecological thinking in Western systems as linear, generally speaking, I'm generalizing, and it departmentalizes, how things are working. It says this ecosystem is separate to this ecosystem, which is separate to this ecosystem. And a lot of Maori models, indigenous models, are based on this idea of them being like cyclical, embedded, and as you sort of talk to sort of whakapapa. How do we navigate the tensions between those two ways of viewing the same thing?
Not that it's for me to say, but that early classification came from Linnaeus in, I think, the 17th century, where there was a model built around what is the kingdom, what is the subspecies, what is the level and understanding of each of those groups, and that they can determine a difference when something else shifts into another level of classification. At the moment, there's 7 models of biodiversity index that exist. None of them are indigenous. So, just out of interest, I've been writing an indigenous biodiversity index that focuses on subjective relationships between environments to inform mainstream thinking that there's another way of knowing the importance of creating relationships, and that the subjectivity that has been so staunchly avoided for however many centuries in terms of an objective science-based argument is flawed. It's those stories that matter, and the fact that those stories change to match contemporary interests and demands, and in that they remain contemporary forever because we keep reconstituting them. And in that subjectivity, the complexity and richness is maintained by a continuous overlay of new practitioners that have a different view on the same idea. And it allows us as Indigenous people to be immortal. And there was only ever 2 ways of achieving that, which was to create a cell that could live forever, or the means of transmitting ideas that allowed that idea and therefore those people to be immortal. And this is how we've achieved it.
When you talk about a cell being immortal and included within the environment as a living ancestor or something that we're in constant relationship, if you think about that context, how does climate change affect that relationship between the immortal cell, which is part of the environment, and something which arguably, I'm not taking a stance either side on here, that is potentially we are part of that change?
Well, over the last couple of years, we've initiated three conferences that are Indigenous knowledge, climate change and wellbeing in humans. And we've invited 20 different Indigenous nations and leading climate change scientists to all three conferences. We've had one or two turn up, but at the last minute, they, for some reason, tend to pull out from coming in. But always plenty of Indigenous representation, not so much from mainstream. And I can see how it would be, you know, perceived as quite a dangerous environment to come into, and it is. It's never going to end well. There's going to be a lot of hard questions. And so they've got to be quite brave to come in there in the first place. In that space, with a number of Indigenous, including Māori, the concept of climate change isn't new. It's been seen before. And you can track some of those back through proxy measures, either through isotopes of oxygen and ice, or even through Kodi tree, or through the growth rate of stalactites. There's a shitload of things you can do around, you know, measuring when those have happened. And there's been a couple of mini ice ages in the past. I've seen paintings from Amsterdam of the canals all frozen solid. So there's information out there about where climate has moved before. Never to this extent, though. Never as large as this. And one of the ways that we've tracked climate in the past, and still do, has been through a process called maramataka, of tracking what we're seeing on a day-to-day basis across one rotation of the moon and at certain times of high tide, low tide, to see what it's causing in animals and in plants. And whether people like it or not, they react like animals to climate change. And so we're seeing things in humans at the same time. So the first thing about it is, for a number of Indigenous people, climate isn't seen as something completely new and out of hand. It's been around a few times and gone a few times. We're not suggesting that it's going to leave anytime soon or that we're the experts on it. But the partnership with Google represents an opportunity for accessing data gathering mechanisms to look at what contributions anybody that's from the Pacific could provide, of which Māori are one, but with the knowledge that the Pacific, if you were to be in space, it's the single biggest artifact on the planet. From space, you can't see past either side of the Pacific. It covers a 180-degree view, and it travels from, you know, above Japan and all the way down to the Antarctic Circle. So it's huge. Why I'm telling you that is that the climate for the whole planet comes from the Pacific. And yet there's been no discussion or questions with those people that have lived in the ocean of the Pacific for the longest about what they've seen, what they've noted in changes. So it's the dumbest shit to not ask people that have lived there for thousands and thousands of years, what have you noticed? But to take the word of contemporary scientists who have got an objective view to begin with that wants to cut all of that out and see what they say. If it was the combination, that wouldn't make sense.
I wrote a paper last year that had quite a lot of Pacific Island material in it. And yes, international people couldn't cope with the notion of Pacifica, but they knew to object to the term small island states.
That's what they got shitty about.
Yeah. So we eventually, we asked a lot of people and have ended up calling it large ocean.
It's funny, isn't it, what people get worked up about? Like, I remember, like, at that last Observatory thing after my presentation, guy coming up to me and just was mortified by the fact that I wouldn't grade people down for not believing in climate change. He was like, "No, you have to." I was like, "No, it's not on the marking matrix. It's not part of their learning outcomes to believe in what I believe. It's not my job, you know." It was just, yeah, he was mortified by it. I mean, you're trying to, here's what I explained to Ring. As soon as you sort of say things like that, people go, "Oh, you're a climate denier." I'm like, "No. No, I'm not a climate denier." It's this weird tension that you end up sitting with it.
So we're going to play the rest of your conversation next week.
Yes.
What do we know so far?
we know that this man does some pretty heavy thinking. I think it was interesting. We'll come to this more next week, but I was, this notion of whakapapa as being something of action was remarkable. And I was sort of doing some backcountry skiing in Ohau, and I was saying to my partner, Catherine, that, you know, this is a form of whakapapa, what we're doing here. The way we're working with the mountain and having our son with us, et cetera, is a form of whakapapa. And she sort of paused and thought for a moment, and she has a Swiss passport, my mother-in-law is Swiss, and brought up the fact that when we're in Switzerland, her place of origin is a mountain called Grindelwald, and it was very important for her to take James, our son, to Grindelwald because that was her whakapapa, that was her place of being. And this notion of whakapapa is far more delicate and nuanced than I ever thought it was. I had a very, I'll say, westernized view of it being a lineal thing. And when you sort of have it explained to you in more depth, you start realizing that it's something that is really embedded. And I think something which is really beautifully New Zealand about it and the way that we engage with our environment. And maybe it's one of the things that kind of separates us from other countries is that viewpoint. And it's something we should all be very thankful for, I think.
We'll hear more next week. Who are we going out to today?
Well, I thought I'd carry on the theme of New Zealand music. This band has the honour of being simultaneously the best, one of the best bands I've ever seen, and also one of the most horrendous, awful bands I've ever seen. So when I saw them, I've seen them about three times.
They can't be that bad then.
Oh, it was worse than bad, Sam. It was awful. It was awful. And it cost me $50 to watch this horrendous just catastrophe unfold in front of me. Anyway, so this is Battle Space, and the song's called Argonaut, and it's one of the Green Yellow tunes.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles as safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. Tahu's back. We had a contribution from Tahu McKenzie. Tim Lynch has been with me today. He brought his conversation with Dr. Iharangi Heki. I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mā te wā.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.